Hi, everybody. Hello and welcome. It's me, Matthew, and here's my friend James.
I walk, I talk, so why can't I get any clocks? I want to buy a cuckoo clock from Gabriel Knight. I want him to be my cuckoo bird.
Cuckoo clocks.
I want him to lay an egg in my nest. I'll look after his egg. I'll raise his egg
as though
it were my own.
Is there a little him in the egg, or is it just always an egg?
Matthew, do you not know the truth about the cuckoo?
Well, I do know that the cuckoo is an imposter.
The cuckoo will put an egg in the nest.
But what's Gabriel's egg?
Gabriel, Matthew, is the greatest cuckoo bird.
Sure.
He is the greatest cuckold of adventure game history. Matthew, there have been many.
Put that on the box.
There was the surfer from Maniac Mansion.
Uh-huh.
Matthew, there was the guy who runs the ball of twine in Sam and Max Hit
the
Road.
Yep, all great
and
characters.
There was Cuckoo Clocks. Gabriel Knight from Gabriel Knight, the Beast Within, not Tim Curry. Tim Curry is no cuckold, except when he wants to be.
I suppose. Matthew. I don't know that that's ever happened.
Anything can happen on Halloween.
So in Gabriel Knight 2, the Beast Within, if you are walking down the street as Gabriel Knight and you click on the Cuckoo Clocks door, he just pauses in front of the window and he says, Cuckoo Clocks.
Cuckoo clocks. Now, you need a cuckoo clock at
you
some point
do.
In that game to wake something up, right?
I can't remember. It's extremely ridiculous.
The puzzles in that one, Matthew. The puzzles in that one.
You have
cuckoo
to
clocks.
Record someone talking about wolves.
That's actually one of my favorite. That I thought was brilliant.
It's great, but it would never occur to a player.
You know, as a youth, eventually when I figured it out, I felt so satisfied. What you have to do is record a conversation with one of the NPCs, and this only happens once, and then you have to edit their tape to make them say something else. And it's actually, like, you cut the words and you paste them, and I thought it was pretty neat.
It's not unsatisfying, it's just a bit of a logical leap, I think.
Yes, he says something like, Donald? I don't think the character's name was Donald.
Donald, sure,
sure.
Yeah.
Donald, Herr Dr. Klingman here. Show our wolves to Mr. Knight?
Yes. Yeah.
And then Donald, his name definitely wasn't. It was like Reichstag or something.
But
Reichstag says, yes, Mr. Knight.
Takes place in Germany, you see.
It does take place in Germany. And then you get licked by a wolf.
Oh, yeah.
And you get a real weird look from Reichstag, the zookeeper.
There is something. Oh, there's, like, once you're done talking to him and you leave, he has this one little voice line where he goes, whatever.
So it's an FMV game, full motion video, back when that was almost trying to be a thing. And it makes the adventure game conventions so bizarre because people stand in place just wiggling slightly, staring at each other. And then their, like, greetings and their farewells are just so incredibly unnatural, but they try to make them natural, which makes it worse. Like when you're sitting at your lawyer's office, you know, Gabriel will just occasionally shift in the chair, but it's always
just
the same shift.
Staring at each other silently while you as the player try to figure out what to do next.
And because they're real human beings, it's
right,
so much
on video.
Weirder than when they were just cartoon characters.
Yes. It's a delight to see these people behaving so bonkers. Also, Gabriel is played not by Tim Curry as he was in the first one, but by, oh, who knows what the actor's name is, but he was a barista on a few episodes of Frasier.
He was indeed on Frasier. Now, Tim Curry returns for Gabriel Knight 3, Blood of the Sacred, Blood of the Damned, a game that is incredibly unwieldy to try to get running on a modern computer, let alone just a game that has a lot of issues.
It's doing some extremely kludgy things with 3D.
It is. It was. Each Gabriel Knight was sort of pushing a boundary. The first one was pushing sort of what you could do with the classic Sierra game format, and I think it did an excellent job.
With nice animated sprites on painted backgrounds.
Oh, gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous.
And lovely voice acting.
Great
voice
acting.
From Mark Hamill is in that one?
Oh, it's got an incredible cast.
Yeah.
Michael Dorn.
Oh, yeah.
Mark Hamill. Tim Curry, of course.
Who plays Grace? I forget who plays Grace.
I think Leah Remini.
Really?
Which is, I think I might be wrong about that.
Okay. Well, but I do remember that it's someone who's actually still famous today.
I think it's like Caroline in the City or something. No, issue there is that it is Grace Nakamura, and I don't think in the first one it was a Japanese woman.
It definitely was not.
Yeah.
Let's see. We've got, it's Leah Remini.
Well, there you go, Matthew.
And the narrator is Virginia Capers.
That's right. It's got Ephraim Zimblist Jr. It's
what?
Got it all.
Is that really a person?
Oh, it's got an Ephraim Zimblist Jr.
Wow. Matthew. Okay.
It's got a terrific cast. It's got gorgeous art. The MIDI compositions, are what they are, but the compositions are great. It's just that they come through in a little synthesizer.
Yes, the music's good. The instrument is not. Oh yeah, okay. So Virginia Capers, who plays the narrator, who I seem to recall speaks in a Cajun accent.
Oh boy, howdy, does she?
You might know her from Howard the Duck.
Oh, my favorite.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Okay.
Some other things I've never heard of. She was on a few episodes of ER. Mm. Apparently, Fresh Prince. Snoops, whatever that is. The Hughleys.
Okay, what are we doing?
Anyway, sorry, I was looking at Virginia Capers.
Okay. Gabriel, in the second game, joins a gay werewolf club.
Yeah.
Matthew.
Yeah.
He joins a club of rich gay werewolves, and the richest, gayest werewolf takes an interest in him, wants to give him the special chomp.
I forget about the weird touching scene.
There's a lot of weird things that go on, Matthew. It ends with an opera, if it wasn't gay enough for you already. Mm. And the opera sequence is extraordinary.
There's a number of very confusing puzzles that you have to get through in order to get to the opera. Uh-huh. And it ends with your main character on stage doing something, I think, to unmask the werewolf.
Well, so Wagner, along with his secret lover, King Ludwig II, designed a special opera house with crystalline harmonics.
Yes.
And the crystalline harmonics, when just the right notes are played in the opera, Matthew, will force a werewolf to transform.
That's right.
Even though the moon is not out, it will force any werewolf to get really sweaty. Mm-hmm. And then he'll pull on his collar like, and then he'll start to transform. And for some reason, Gabriel in this state, after having been menaced by a pigeon, decides that he needs to get into costume and perform in the opera for no good reason. You almost like murder one of the actors to take his costume.
Yeah, it's the only way to progress through the game is to do that. You can try anything else in the game will just end.
Yes.
And so apparently that's where we have to go.
Yes.
Get this guy on stage. Mm-hmm. And then he transforms for some reason.
Because he got the special love from the gay werewolf.
That's right. He got the love bite. I forgot about that.
Matthew, they had a little love together.
That's right.
And then
In
the woods. They went into the woods and out of the woods and home before. So there's a chomp, and then there's an opera, and then there's a wolf chase through the basement of the opera that's fucking inscrutable. Because you have to close doors behind you to try to trap the other wolf.
That's
so that you can lead him into the... Well, this is all a spoiler, so we're not going to spoil the dramatic conclusion of Gabriel Knight 2, The Beast Within.
It's a violent end, though.
It's... Well, you know, these violent delights have violent ends.
Yeah. Yikes. Okay, anyway. There's also a part...
Wait, was that Boss Nass?
Maybe. He was coming out.
Usa making the life play with Dis and Hissin.
There's a part... it was right after he gets bit.
Yes.
Where he wakes up in a basement, and Grace Nakamura, his assistant, is tending to him, caring for him. And she glances forlornly at the window where a pigeon has landed.
Yes.
And she says... You have a visitor.
She does do that, Matthew. And then if you have the right item, she takes the pigeon.
She reaches... Okay, so she takes a bread roll out of her pocket that she stole from the cafe, sprinkles it on the windowsill, and while the pigeon is pecking away, she just reaches out, grabs it, and stuffs it into her coat.
Stuffs it into her coat, and she has it in there for presumably the next several weeks.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know about weeks, but it's...
A long period of time goes by.
A long period passes. She's driving around the countryside, going to museums.
Oh, she drives for several hours across Germany with a pigeon in her coat.
With a pigeon in her coat.
And then at some point you release the pigeon to cause some kind of distraction,
or something in a museum. So these are conventions that all work totally fine when
in a cartoon.
Animated point-and-click adventure. But as soon as you have, like, full-motion video recorded humans...
So Grace comes off as so deranged in Gabriel Knight 2. It's really incredible. And I don't blame the actress at all. It's the material she has and the bizarre style. Like, so Gabriel comes off as deranged, too, but there's... what they make Grace do takes it to new heights.
Yeah.
She... has to blame a child for urinating on an antique chair in a museum.
Yeah.
But the only water in all of Germany is holy water from a shrine that people make a pilgrimage to hundreds of miles away.
So she has to steal some holy water from a shrine, then drive hundreds of miles to the museum, wait for a child to play on a chair, then sprinkle the holy water on the chair.
When no one's looking.
Then tell a guard that the child urinated
Der
on
Kinder.
It. Der Kinder. That's right.
Der Kinder. She points to the chair and yells, "Der Kinder," and then the guard chases the child away, and then she has her run of the place.
Yeah. Ugh, okay.
She runs around with the pigeon in her coat, Matthew. There's also her incredible jealousy with the Terry Garr, who runs the castle.
That's also bizarre. Yeah, there's this woman. It's one of those games. Mm. And I can't even blame this on, well, it was all men writing these games because...
No, Jane Jensen.
Yeah. So, I don't know. So...
It's very Anne Rice-ian, but Anne Rice through a very particular filter.
Yeah. Yeah, so anyway, there are two women in Gabriel's life, and Grace just seems to determine that the German woman is a threat.
Mm-hmm.
Muscling in on her precious man or something.
Yes.
It's not a way that women actually behave, and it's often a way that men imagine them to behave. But in this case, there was a woman who wrote the game.
Well, it turns out, of course, that she was in love with a knight, Matthew, but it was, I think, like Gabriel's dead uncle.
I believe you're correct about that.
Yeah, it was the dead uncle. It was Ephraim Zimblis Jr., I believe.
Oh, okay. Well, Matthew, who wouldn't
be?
Yeah.
Yeah. A little bit of that. Ooh, give me a little bit of that Zimblas.
Now, speaking of old-timey names.
Yes.
And old-timey things. We recently saw a film that we both enjoyed. I think you were over the moon for this film, and I had a good time watching it. The Lighthouse.
Oh, I liked it a lot.
Yes.
I liked it quite a bit.
It was... So, here's what I like about it. It's very good to look at.
It's great to look at.
The atmosphere is crafted so elegantly.
Sure.
It's so completely what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It never wavers from its aesthetic.
It does not.
And it's very successfully unsettling, while also, you pointed out, and I agree with this, occasionally being a comedy.
Oh, it's super funny. It's cut like a comedy.
Yeah. Unexpected. Now, it is not what you'd call a laugh riot.
No.
It's no Some Like It Hot, which we also just watched.
We did watch that.
I guess we're just like on a black and white kick. Mm. But it is... The horror is cut with these moments of desperate hilarity.
Yeah, which heightens it, I think.
Yeah.
The contrasts, I think... make everything have more impact.
Mm-hmm. Now, the thing that was a little unsatisfying to me was that there's so much ambiguity that the movie ends and you are left to do the work of deciding what it all meant.
I would agree with that.
And because this movie is concerned with reality and trust, and particularly trusting your own senses and trusting what you're being told... It's unclear how much of it actually happens.
Sure.
And so narratively, it's a bit of a squiggle. And that may be very satisfying to some viewers, but I like something that's a little more conclusive.
Well, so I think it's very conclusive in what it has to say, and I think the sort of events of the plot are kind of incidental to that.
Yes, I agree with that. It's conclusive in its thesis, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And artistic in its plotting.
I suppose so. I think it's what was real and what wasn't, I think at the end of the day, doesn't super matter.
Mm.
You know, I think as long as its point got across, I'm not sure. Like, I'm sure that there are people who would delight in theory crafting and puzzling out, like, oh, well, in this shot, we can tell that this is real for these reasons and this is not. Mm. But, like... who cares?
I agree with that. It doesn't actually matter.
Yeah, I mean, the movie, I think, has something to say about men, among other things.
And isolation.
Yeah, but I think it has more to say about men.
I think you're right about that.
And I think it says what it says pretty clearly.
Well, let's talk about what the what actually is happening on the screen.
Uh-huh.
So it is probably somewhere mid-century, mid-20th century?
Early, I would think.
Yeah. Sure, I don't know. On a lonely...
Don't they say it's like 1917 or 1918?
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
I think so.
Lonely outcropping of rock somewhere in the ocean with a little lighthouse and a shack or two. And
Edward... a lot of farting.
Anyway, there's that. That's another reason I didn't like it. Edward Cullen from Twilight. What's his name?
Edward Cullen. That is his name.
Okay. And the Green Goblin.
Edward Cullen and the Green Goblin, as you've never seen them before, romantic duo.
I know one of them is Willem Dafoe.
That's correct.
The other is Willem Dafriend. No,
What's her name?
Benjamin Squabbles.
It's not Benjamin Squabbles. What's her name?
Timmy Tonsils?
It's not Timmy Tonsils.
Timmy Tonsils. What a name for a band leader.
What? What? Why is he called that?
Because of how he can, his pipes, how he can sing. He opens his mouth real wide to sing, and he's got this, you can see his uvula.
But that's not the tonsil.
That's not the tonsils. No, you can see his tonsils. Why would you want that? I don't know. It's a real selling point. Check out this man's tonsils. No, it's Willem Dafoe and Glembler Felplatz.
It's not Glembler.
We're getting
Felplatz.
Away from human names.
Yeah.
It's not an alien.
He's from space. Glembler Felplatz.
Yeah, but he sounds just a little bit Jewish.
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, we don't know where the 13th tribe went. They might have gone into space, Matthew.
No, what's his name? The kid from Twilight. Shoot, what's his name? He played the vampire.
Bleh. Yeah, he did do that.
Dracula. No.
He was in a Harry Potter.
Was he?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good for him.
I'm pretty sure that was him.
I need a hint. I'm drawing a blank here. It's turning into gibberish in my brain.
Well, let's hear some gibberish.
The guy from Twilight. Menly Hangdown.
It's not Menly Hangdown this time.
No, I know. No. I'm telling you, I need hints.
Okay. It's a human name.
Not a hint.
Oh.
I know he has a human name. I'm not guessing, like, I don't know, Spot.
There is an R.
Robert.
Oh.
Robert the Thief.
It's not Robert
the
Thief.
Why would he call himself that?
What does he steal?
What does he steal?
Yes.
Hearts.
I thought that would be it.
And shoes.
Yes.
Hearts and shoes.
Ooh, don't confuse the two.
Robert. Oh, I said the Robert the Thief because Robert has robber in it.
Oh, robber.
Yep. He's the Hamburglar.
He is the Hamburglar. The original sexy Hamburglar.
Imagine if he played the Hamburglar.
They had a sex Hamburglar.
I remember the
sex Maybe they need a new one.
He would have sex with the hamburgers.
Like Fred the Baker and the donuts.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew, time to fuck the donuts, you'd say.
Can you imagine if that was a slogan?
He would cover his mustache with his finger, and he would take one donut at a time, and he would slide it up and down on his thingus.
Yep.
That's where the munchkins come from. He would poke the munchkins out.
Jeez. And he got caught because when they pulled his pants down, there was powdered sugar all over his crotch.
That's correct, Matthew. And Boston cream.
Ugh!
Okay. Now that's been banned in Boston.
Okay, Robert.
Robert
Clamdigger.
It's not Robert Clamdigger.
Robert Embolism. What?
It's not Robert Embolism.
Robert Mankley?
It's not Robert Mankley.
Is there an M in there? I feel like there's an M. There's no M at all?
No.
Okay. We're without M. Okay, Robert Twinkler.
It's not Robert Twinkler.
Robert Pinkler?
No.
Robert Pink Eye.
It's not Robert Pink Eye.
Robert.
He might have had that.
Pinkerton.
It's not that either.
Robert Panky. Hanky Panky. Robert Hanky Panky.
Robert Hanky Panky.
Robert.
Well, that's what he got up to in Twilight.
Pinkerton. Pinkley?
I see what you're doing now. Okay.
There's a pink.
Pankerton was your closest so
Pankerton.
Far.
Pankerton. Pankinson? Pankson.
Wait, go
Robert
back.
Robert Pattinson. Correct, that's Matthew. His name. Pinkerton Pantson.
It's
Robert Pantson.
It's Robert Pantson.
Robert Pattinson and Clive Blinkler.
And Clive Blinkler.
No, what's his name? Oh, James, I
Matthew.
Lost it.
He's got
Willem Dafoe.
Big
Willem
blue
Dafoe.
Eyes.
Oh my God.
And
Willem
a big
Dafoe.
Blue dick. From the Dance of the Sphinx and the Chimera.
Don't tease me with the big blue dick.
What? How is that a tease?
You know what gets me going.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, so those two actors.
Yes, those two are in
they're
a
alone
lighthouse.
In a lighthouse.
Yes.
And they don't get along.
It is a difficult work situation.
And one reason that you say, and I think I agree with you, that it's about masculinity, for one thing, because in a later interview, Willem Dafoe said that it was.
But I said it first.
You sure did. Is that they're doing, like, there's a lot of, like, trappings of masculine stuff, like nautical things and lumberjacking, and then there's a lot of iconography of phalluses, and then their behavior is, I don't know, there's an aggression, a sexual aggression that they both have. Sometimes it's sexy, sometimes it's aggressive, and sometimes it's both.
There's four modes. There's two characters, and they have their sober mode and their drunk mode.
Yep.
And there's sort of, so you get two characters, but basically four personalities. And each of them is a dysfunctional masculine response to stress, I think. So they are isolated, and there's sort of the shutdown, you know, I'm just going to be the strong, silent type, originally for Robert Pattinson. And then you get a very assertive Defoe in sort of a, like, you know, I'm the commander and you're my subordinate and you're going to listen to me because I'm important and you're not. And then when they drink, they both take on very different roles. That maybe is meant to, I'm not sure, I think they're meant to be maybe a bit more honest, whereas the others are less honest. Honesty and trust are themes throughout the movie. And I don't want to spoil too much. Other than to say that I think the isolation and the stress and their failure to rise to the emotional place they need to be to deal with it, and instead turn to drinking increasingly volatile substances in greater and greater quantities, you know, it leads to a bad time and some funny fart jokes.
I would agree with that, yeah. I don't love the fart jokes, but also I think they're, I hate to say this, important to the film.
Oh, sure.
Because an aspect of the film is keeping things pent up.
Oh, yes. There's a lot of waste. There's a lot of male fluids.
It's not a film to watch with your church going mother.
Well, I don't know. She might be. Yeah. I don't want to speak to your mother. At all.
I know.
No, not yours. I'm speaking to the listener. The hypothetical mother.
The hypothetical church-going mother. Yes. It's, yeah, it's a dirty movie. Not like, oh, how foul.
You mean like The Jerk? Because you thought that was a dirty movie.
I mean it's unclean.
I understand, but
not like it's telling blue humor.
Right. There is, and we don't know if it's a stunt or not, there is an amazing Willem Dafoe ass pretty early in the movie. I don't think this is a spoiler.
Uh-huh.
But I think that a sort of isolated men having sexual urges is definitely part of the whole experience.
Here's my theory about that ass, and no spoilers here.
Yeah.
I think that it is a fantasy vision that belongs to a figure from the viewer's past.
That could be. That could be. Whoever's... It is. It's a real pulsation. It undulates like a thing from the sea.
There's a lot of sea life imagery as well.
There is. So there's, and I don't think this is a spoiler either because it's so early. There's a mermaid and there's an octopus. And the mermaid, I think, is one outlet for sexual attention. And the octopus seems to appear when, I mean, let's just say it, when Robert Pattinson's getting a little bit horny. Or not horny, but he's getting aroused.
Getting a little gay.
Because of Dafoe. Mm-hmm. Something Dafoe's doing is getting him a little bit aroused. I think that's when we see the octopus.
It's troubling. It's horrible and troubling.
Oh, my goodness.
But it's so expertly crafted that if you like that kind of thing, you'll love it.
I enjoyed it, Matthew. The sound design.
Oh,
is,
well, yeah.
Mwah, 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 mwah.
The sound of the movie is amazing. Unfortunately, we watched it on Amazon, which does some very bad encoding with black levels.
Oh, yeah.
So when the screen has a lot of dark and shadow, it gets really clumpy and chunky. Like
yeah. It's very banded.
It doesn't look good. But you can tell this was a movie that was just beautifully shot. It was actually shot with... with antique lenses. They found old like 75-year-old lenses to shoot this movie on, and then, you know, did a lot of like digital filters and stuff.
Sure. Well, I mean, I thought it looked great even with the garbage compression. You know, if you can find a way to watch it without garbage compression, do so. But the composition of the images, even if they were compressy, they were still wonderful images to look at.
Matt. And yeah, a very unusual, shot on 35mm, I think. And so a very square image, something we're not really used to seeing.
35mm isn't square, is it?
Well, almost square. Oh, it's like 1/35 to 1.
Oh.
Think I may be wrong about that, because now that I say that, 1/35 is too conveniently close to 35mm. But it's like, maybe it's like 1.19 to 1, whatever. Well, it is.
You know, the thing about my body,
yeah,
is that
it's square,
is that I am also 1.19 to 1.
Uh-huh.
Matthew, I'm Mr. 5x5. Now, have you heard that song?
Yes,
you have. It's a very good song, Matthew.
Yep.
In it, there's a man who's 5 feet tall and 5 feet wide, and so there's no way of knowing whether he's coming or he's going. He's Mr. 5x5. That you can't tell the front from the back.
That's what the song suggests.
Yeah.
I mean, you really got to have a unique body shape.
You really do. He's a perfect cube, Matthew. He's like from Minecraft.
He is. He is. But, like, not even like a human from Minecraft. Just a square. Just a square block.
Well, and the you can't tell the front from the back makes me think he's cubic, but he also just could be like a, like a big slice of bread or something.
Yeah. Oh, delicious.
Matthew, Mr. 5x5. Five feet tall and 5 feet wide. In the latter case, imagine the thigh gap.
I'm having trouble just positioning this as a human.
Matthew, I am human. Some Like It Hot is a movie you can watch.
Okay, so let's talk about that. We also watched Some Like It Hot.
It's a good
which
movie.
Was a little more A to B to C.
It's a little Marilyn Monroe, except at the end she does kind of just ignore the entire story, but that's fine.
Okay, so...
I mean, not to spoil Some Like It Hot. What, 50-year-old movie now? More than that.
More than that. 60. 58 it came out.
Oh,
so
my
I
God.
Think it's 62 years old.
Oh, wowie, wow.
Is that right? Am I doing that math right? Whatever, it doesn't
matter.
Maybe,
Matthew.
40, 56, well, whatever. The point is, it's very funny. Stop, don't look at me like that, James.
It
James,
is,
give me a look.
It is a funny movie.
So, as of course you know, I'm sure, Billy Wilder, and who else is in it? Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis.
Tony Curtis.
And there's a cross-dressing mix-up.
It is a farce.
Ridiculous hijinks. Marilyn Monroe's in there. She falls in love.
She does, Matthew. She sings a song. She shakes her tush. She's got, for the time, considering, incredible titty, Matthew.
Yes.
It is just,
there's no
there
other
are
way to
shots
say it.
Where it just looks like her tits are out.
It okay,
and they are big and jiggly.
She is wearing some really stunning dresses.
Oh yeah.
Throughout the film, but then when it's time for like her big scenes around the end, she is wearing these gowns that are doing like sort of a nude illusion thing.
It is, yes.
And I will say, not providing a ton of support, so she has a very natural shape.
Mm-hmm. That's
and
fair to say.
It is. Her proportions are eye-catching.
They are. Also, her bum when she jiggles.
Oh, my goodness. So there's a low-cut dress that she's wearing at one point with no visible panty lines. And her movements are hypnotic.
Yes. Now this is the very thing. This is the tragedy of her life, how objectified she was. She was also very funny.
She is a very funny presence in the film.
And a good actress. I mean, like, you know, she's playing a character who's meant to be pretty dumb, but, you know, you gotta be smart to play a character who's funny and dumb.
So we watched this in part because we just stumbled upon a YouTube video about the making of Some Like It Hot. So we watched the making of before we watched the actual movie. So we watched the making of thing, which was fascinating, and then I went and found it on Amazon. And it's... you know, it was a struggle to make the film. Apparently, Marilyn was very tense about her acting ability, and it sounds like had some insecurity issues about her ability to be on film. And that was a real struggle for her.
It's all captured in the Elton John song, Candle in the Wind.
Sure. Now, we also just watched Hail Caesar.
Oh, we watched Hail Caesar. We did watch that.
I think we did talk about that, didn't we?
I don't know, but it was great.
So we watched Hail Caesar. The reason that I bring that up is because there's an editor played by Frances McDormand in the film who's just stunning, and mm-hmm. I wish she was in it more. But she's a fantastic character. And in a scene with her, we discover the amount of work that she has done to rescue a, let's call it lackluster performance from an actor and cut it into a scene that actually looks very good. Mm-hmm. And knowing that they had to do literally dozens of takes, I think they said something like 60 takes on one of those lines with Marilyn.
Yeah.
They had to do over and over and over. But the final product, the thing that is actually on film, on screen, is really funny.
Oh, yeah. It's a very good movie. Now, you know, for my money, I am going to say that, I don't know, The Airplane has more laughs per minute. But in terms of filmmaking, mm-hmm. It's excellent, excellent filmmaking. They're very, very expertly made. Like there's a character whose shoes are basically a character unto themselves, and when you see those shoes, you know what they mean, and it's set up and paid off on very, very nicely.
Yeah, it really it's great. It's so good, and the plotting of the film is very good. Never a moment where you're like, all right, this is kind of dragging. Mm-hmm. In the making of documentary, there's this nice story about how they did a screening mm-hmm. Of the film before it was released, and just deadly silence. Nobody was laughing. It was a huge flop. Except for Steve Allen, for some reason.
He loved it.
Who was there. I don't know if he was involved in the film or what, but he was there. And so the studio was like, okay, you have to cut 15 minutes from the film. Mm-hmm. And Billy Wilder was like, okay, I'll see what I can do. And then they had a screening the next week, and he was at Westwood, I think?
Sure.
And he was like, all right, I made some cuts. Turned out he removed 60 seconds from the film instead of like 15 to 20 minutes as the studio wanted. And he's like, that's it. That's all I'm taking out. And that was the right call, because I was thinking when we were watching it, could we do without this scene? Could we cut this? And I do think
there's some parts, if they went, it wouldn't be that big a deal, but
I could see 5 minutes coming out.
Yeah.
to like, critique this, like, classic of American cinema.
But like, you know, they don't need to. It's not like it drags. It maybe drags a little bit in a couple places, but it's not like it drags. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One thing that I compared it to while we were watching, this is going to sound a little weird, is an episode of Seinfeld.
Oh, it's very Seinfeld, yeah.
In that, like, there's a lot of, like, goofy misunderstandings and schemes that all come together in the end. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, the way that things fit together. Mm-hmm. There's a coincidence towards the third act mm-hmm. that is so ridiculously implausible, you must not stop to think about it.
I mean, it's, yeah, for sure. But I think that that's true of most of the movie, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you think too hard about the deception that the whole movie hinges on, a lot of stuff starts to fall apart.
It's true. Please, it's one of those movies that's like, please do not think too hard about the plot points of this film. Just sit back and enjoy yourself.
Yeah, and
it's a fun little farce.
And I don't think that's in any way to its detriment. Like, I think part of the joke is some of the things that are, like, so obvious to us, the audience, that the supporting characters are just kind of blowing off.
But yes. Like,
you know, but that makes it funnier.
Mm-hmm. There's also Tony Curtis does, at one point, he has three identities. He's who he actually is. He's Josephine, I think?
I think so.
In disguise as a woman.
The bosom buddy.
And then he's also doing a deception as sort of this millionaire oil heir. Mm. And he's doing a voice that was apparently supposed to be a Cary Grant impression. Mm-hmm. And it's ludicrous. He just sounds like he has a stuffy nose.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Peter Sellers in his performance. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking specifically about Merkin Muffley, the president from Dr. Strangelove.
Sure.
Anyway, who originally was played with the stuffy nose, and then they had to reshoot it because it was too funny.
Oh, just my goodness.
Bananas. Anyway, apparently they showed this film to Cary Grant at some point, mm-hmm. and Cary Grant was like, I don't talk like that. That's my Cary Grant impression.
Matthew, now he is said to have made love to men's asses.
That's true. Cary Grant is said to have been family.
Well, Matthew, I welcome him and
Randolph Scott.
I welcome Randolph Scott and Cary mm-hmm. Grant into the boudoir of sin.
Mm-hmm. Archibald Leach.
What?
It's Cary Grant's real name.
Oh, I knew that for one point in my life.
Yes.
Now it's gone, Matthew. Cuckoo clock. That's what time passes, mm-hmm. and all we are left with is cuckoo clocks
and the wind. So that was Some Like It Hot.
It's really a good movie.
Really
it's
liked it.
Entertaining. Marilyn is a sex object, yes, but also a funny comedian, mm-hmm. And the songs are very good.
Oh yeah, and a great singer, of course.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've obviously heard her stuff out of context, but I think I did see this movie in college, but seeing it now in context, mm-hmm. Like it really lands.
Yeah, it does. She, you know, because the songs are relevant to what's going on in the actual story of the film. So she's singing as a performer. She's sort of a, you know, nightclub singer, and the songs that she's singing are relevant, and you can hear the heartache and the emotion and everything, and she's great.
Yeah, I think that another thing with her, of course, is that she's been so parodied and mimicked and homaged.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
That it's interesting just to go back and just see before all that. It's like when you go back to the first Austin Powers.
Oh, yeah.
And you're like, oh, all of these things that were driven into the ground, like
yeah,
they started somewhere,
and they were funny because they were new.
Many of them were actually funny. Not all of them, but many of them were actually funny.
She's a Man Baby is deeply problematic.
Oh, well, there is that.
But like Shagadelic or Oh Behave or Groovy or like whatever, like all these things.
Well, before it was like
that are so hacky.
Yeah, it was stupid and funny in the movie.
Yeah.
And Marilyn, you know, when you take it away from all the like Madonna homages and that sort of thing and just go back to her actual performances, they're quite good.
Yeah, yeah. I will say, like, I was watching the film and I was like, I kind of want to watch Dick Tracy now just for Madonna's performance in that.
Not as good.
Oh, I'm aware of that.
Not as good.
I'm definitely aware of that. Maybe I just want to watch, what's the one, is it, what's the Madonna song where she actually does do the tribute to Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend?
Material Girl.
Material
and that
Girl.
Is
That's
merely
it.
A music video. You don't have to watch a whole motion picture
of it. Oh, what a relief.
Matthew. Now, Warren Beatty was the Dick Tracy.
Yes.
And he was giving her the Dick Tracy.
Oh, was
at
he?
At that time, I think.
I didn't know that.
Matthew, he stuffed it in. And she said, I'm like a virgin. Wink-a-dink-a-doo.
Stuffed for the very first time.
Stuffed, Matthew. Al Pacino is in it. As
That's
the
true.
Villain.
As the law.
He's what? No, he's not.
Oh, he's yes, the villain. No, he says I am the law.
Oh, I see. Of course, he's Big Boy Caprice. He's got a hump.
Forgot about that name,
Matthew.
Oh, we should talk about Little Bonaparte.
Oh, Little Bonaparte is a revelation.
Oh my God! So there's a character at the very end of Some Like It Hot, played by the wonderful actor Nehemia Parsoff, who is doing an accent that we rewound that scene many times to
it's
hear.
It's not just the accent, the voice,
the delivery,
everything about it.
His face.
It is wild. He's got also this hearing aid apparatus going on.
Mm-hmm.
It is, the movie has built up to a crescendo, and he is certainly the climax of, we almost cross over into a whole different universe.
It really is. That's the thing that makes me feel like very like late series Seinfeld when they
sure.
would have like the Johnny Cochran character.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, what is this cartoon?
Yes.
That we're suddenly in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think that he's not like completely out of universe.
Not completely, but
he's just
teeter.
At the edge.
You teeter
yeah.
into something else.
Well, something very fun that the movie does is it's a little bit of like farce. It's a
yeah.
little bit of like silly, kind of modern farce because of
yeah.
58 that it was made, but it's set in the 30s.
20s.
Oh, I keep saying 30s.
I
Why
know.
Do I keep saying
you
that?
Love
set
it.
In the 20s.
29.
Mm.
Prohibition.
Yes, of course. Anyway, so there's parts of it that feel very modern, like going into the 60s
mm-hmm.
About the movie. But it's set in the 20s, and so it's using a lot of conventions from silent movies and gangster films in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you've got like the goofy, zany sex comedy Tony Curtis stuff going on,
yeah.
then the movie switches to this very noir style, and you have this conflict of two very different genres of character mm-hmm. coming together. It's a real pleasure to watch.
It's a little bit like when Pee-wee Herman appeared on 30 Rock.
Yes.
That's a little bit what, or perhaps Martin Short on Arrested Development.
Yes, it's, what this little Napoleon character, little Bonaparte character.
Little Bonaparte is a bit like one of those.
Mm-hmm.
We have the established 30 Rock milieu by the time that happens,
mm-hmm.
and then they drop Paul Rubens
yes.
as this hemophiliac.
Tiny-handed.
Yeah, with tiny hands.
Twirl for me, Jenna, twirl.
Keep twirling.
Keep twirling. Dance for me.
Yes.
It's extremely funny. Oh, and that ends with, like, another great... Like, this is a moment where Jenna's character really gelled for me on 30 Rock, where after he dies... Spoiler alert for 30 Rock, I guess. After Paul Reubens' character dies... Tina Fey's character, Liz and Jack, are having, like, a moment, like a character moment with some heart. And Jenna comes up and she's like, hey, gang, we got a boogie.
Yes.
And it's like a real good moment where it's like, this is a character who knows how to run scams and knows when it's time to, like, when it's time to bounce, when it's time to get on the train and get out of town. It's so fun. Anyway, Little Bonaparte is just the most watchable character I've ever seen.
He... talks like Mother Mayo.
He...
Now, nobody on this show is going to know what Mother Mayo is.
Oh, a few will, but...
Mayonnaise!
I'm sure Joanne is familiar. Joanne remembers Mother Mayonnaise. Who is Mother Mayonnaise, James? What? Who is Mother Mayo? Like, what is her role in life?
Oh, you didn't like... I once unspooled for you the whole backstory about Mother Mayo, and you didn't care for it one bit.
For some reason in my head, she works for a movie studio? I think that's incorrect.
I am an executive.
Oh,
no, I don't know that she is.
Anyway,
I greenlit the Shawshank Redemption.
That's a good choice.
Mayonnaise?
Did you want more mayonnaise in the film?
I only eat Shawshank.
Oh, I really thought you were going to say I only ate mayonnaise.
Mayonnaise?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah?
In this economy. Certainly. Mother May, Matthew, we can't have mayonnaise in this economy.
I guess not. We have vegan mayonnaise in the fridge. I forgot to get real mayonnaise.
That's... untrue. You did get real mayonnaise.
Did I?
You did.
Oh, good for me.
You did.
Oh, what a surprise.
Also, the vegan mayonnaise is pretty good.
Okay, well, let's throw a parade for me and the mayonnaise.
Mayonnaise.
At last, a true hero recognized.
Bayonnaise or mayonnaise?
What's bayonnaise?
Bayonnaise.
Oh, Bernays.
Bernays and Fields. Quality, comfort, and price. That's nice.
All right, now we're going more obscure with commercials for mid-90s Massachusetts furniture emporiums.
The 80s, too, Matthew. Bernie and Fields. Quality, comfort, and price. That's nice.
Now, they do have those lovely commercials for Bernie's and Phil's.
Man,
Bernie and Phil's. But what Bernie and Phil's does not have is an IMAX theater.
The Motion Odyssey movie ride. But we can't get into that because we need to talk about Model Land.
Oh, gosh. Yes, you're absolutely right. Poor Model Land. Tyra seems to be going a little unhinged with the delayed opening of her theme park.
She put on a little crown.
She did. She's posted an Instagram about it. So good for her. In the book Model Land, we're up to chapter 41. Stone to bone, comma, and flesh.
Oh, and flesh.
Yes.
I prefer that, to
stone
be honest.
To bone.
Yes.
And flesh.
Mm-hmm.
That does not mean that it is stone that should be boned.
Oh, no.
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 I guess you could.
Oh.
It's not a donut.
Oh, a time to fuck the donut.
So we start with Tookie having a dream.
A dream.
And the suggestion that the entire book up until this point has been just a dream.
How would that have made you feel?
I was reading this on the balcony, and I might have just jumped off. So she's having a fainting dream.
Mm-hmm.
She fainted at the sight of Creamy coming over the wall into Model Land, and now she's waking up, and Creamy's standing over her. Miracle's there.
Yeah.
It's my mother, she says. She's surrounded by her weird friends in CL.
Mm-hmm.
And then Creamy demands to be taken to the Belladonna.
Yes.
Creamy
knows how to get shit done.
She does. She is the only protagonist in this book.
I agree.
So she demands to be taken to the Belladonna. She's moving things along. She's like, this book needs more narrative momentum.
Yep.
And everyone's like, and she's like, you're useless. And she just starts marching off.
Mm-hmm.
It's described, blah, 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 crossing the Golden M Plaza. Golden exclamation marks followed her as she made her way to the O. I just really like that line.
Golden exclamation marks followed her as she made her way to the O.
Yeah. So she's marching up to a statue of the Belladonna, and she's like, listen to me.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I don't think she's got any demands exactly. She's just like, look at me, look at me.
Uh-huh.
And the statue of the Belladonna starts to move and starts to sing a song.
Mm-hmm.
And Creamy's like, will you stop that ridiculous singing? Creamy is all of us.
Yes.
And so, meanwhile, as this is happening, there's the 7-7 tournament, or the 7-7 tournament. We don't know how to pronounce it because it's the number 7 and the word 7.
Mm-hmm.
is happening in the stadium.
Yeah.
We're in a void here where I'm having a real hard time placing and picturing things.
Well, Creamy's out in the plaza. What do you mean? And the tournament's happening in the stadium.
And I guess everyone has gone away?
Most people are in the stadium.
Most people are in the stadium.
Yeah.
But not Bravo. Because as all this is happening,
yeah.
Tookie sees Bravo
yeah.
just staring at the stadium.
Yep.
So I guess he's out there.
Yeah.
And he sees that she is with CL, the famous uh-huh. model. Mm-hmm. He sees that she is with two horrible
monster people.
Mud-covered monster people
uh-huh.
who have been climbing up a mountain for months and are described as gaunt and starving,
uh-huh.
And that they're talking to an animated statue of their ruler.
Yeah.
And so what he does is he looks at Tookie, he licks his thumb,
mm-hmm.
and he pantomimes wiping her eyebrow.
Yep.
I don't know how you pantomime wiping someone's eyebrow from a great distance, but it's very unclear that that's wiping an eyebrow.
It is. It really is. That's
it looks
true.
Like you're thumbing a lift.
Uh-huh.
With a wet thumb.
Blah.
So anyway, Tookie's still mad at him, apparently,
uh-huh.
for saying that she was the ugly girl or something.
Sure.
She says, "You might as well be dead to me, Bravo."
Mm-hmm.
Again, another line that I just like.
And what a swing from Tookie. I mean, like, you know, fair enough, but just what is Tookie? Anyway.
So then the... Creamy says, "You and I need to have a serious talk," to the Belladonna. And the Belladonna says, "Go to that zip-zap."
Mm-hmm.
And so they're like, "Oh, okay, I guess she's going to talk to us."
Yeah.
So they all go to the zip-zap. And off they go. Wait a minute. Actually, do they? Okay. The entire zip-zap thing is condensed into a single phrase in mm-hmm. a sentence. In seconds, they had all slid through the long tube and emerged at the end of a dim corridor.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't 100% get that they had gone into the zip-zap.
Oh, that's the journey.
I guess. So it smells like blood oranges again.
Mm-hmm.
They hear unseen voices chanting ooh and ah. Tookie glanced at her friends. The Belladonna had ordered them to the ooh-ah.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember what that is. It's a spa or something?
I don't remember either, but they do moan ooh and ah.
Mm. There's a tableau on the wall of a cobblestone street church tower's a burgeoning butcher shop. What the fuck is a burgeoning butcher shop?
Well, is the shop burgeoning or the butcher?
I don't know. Is he just getting his first shipment of calf
today or something? It might be a butcher.
A cobbler's shop and a spinning windmill, church bells. It's like a little fairy tale, whatever. Mm-hmm. They're shown into another room. And there's a statue of the Belladonna in there. It
uh-huh.
starts to crack and fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
Dylan says, as we say in the big boot, in the...
Big so Boutique Nation,
no,
right?
No, the Boo Big Teak.
The Boo Big Teak, okay.
The Boo Big Teak Nation.
Uh-huh.
You boo break it, you boo buy it.
They do say that there, Matthew.
Chunks are falling off the statue, and it's revealing that inside is the actual Belladonna in the flesh.
Uh-huh.
The end of the book. Now, end of chapter 41. Now we're on to chapter 42,
mm-hmm.
Les Trois Copines.
What does that mean?
I don't know. Something.
The three copine.
Copines. I have no idea what a copine is.
It's a copayment for penis.
No.
What a voice. Talk like that all the time.
No.
You missed it. No, it was better before.
No.
There we go.
No.
Now say something else like that.
Welcome to my copay for the penis.
This is great.
You
keep
like
going.
Is this yes, like a little
Matthew.
Bonaparte?
Yes.
Oh, thank you for listening, everybody. I've got to go green light the Shawshank Condemnation.
Oh.
It's the prequel.
Oh, my goodness.
It's very difficult to talk that way.
Well, you need to learn.
Okay, well, let's go practice.
Oh, you mean with kissing?
With kissing, James. I want you to kiss me.
No, kisses are trouble.
But here's
Cuckoo clouds.
James, with the quarantine that we're in.
The kissing quarantine.
But I don't want the kisses to be quarantined.
But you go out into the world, Matthew. You suck the air. And then I worry about your mouth.
James, first of all, I wear a mask when I go out.
Sure. Oh, so you're so
I go
masked.
Out once or twice a week. There's very little risk of anything happening. And I just mm-hmm. go to gardens, empty gardens. There's three There's three nice community gardens.
Like little
I feel
Edie.
Like I was going to say like Tori Amos,
oh.
but I feel like some just lost maiden wandering the gardens,
uh-huh.
gazing forlornly at plants. And I'm not getting diseases from them.
You might be. You're sucking their air, Matthew. What if someone...
Sniff a sick tulip?
What if somebody tooted on the tulips?
Okay.
And then you go in for a sniff, and then you get all their filth.
No. No, I don't want that.
See? That's why you gotta watch out for Defoe. He's always at it.
The point is...
Yeah.
I want kisses.
Well, if you want kisses, you better wrap up this thing.
Okay. Then, everybody, thank you so much for listening. Thank you for being a supporter. Thank you for being a friend. Thank you for... Oh, we have a message from... Hold on, let me call it up here. We've got we got a comment.
Oh, I thought it was like it just came in.
No. Shit. I almost forgot that we had a little...
Oh, my
little message
God,
here.
Who could it be?
Where are we?
Now, my reaction here, I truly don't know. It could be anything. It could be dangerous.
What are we doing? This is Cozy Pants.
Are we? I don't know. What's the... Click on...
Cozy Pants, here we are. I put all the messages that we receive in this document.
Ah.
Joanne says.
I have
so many thoughts on the Phantom discussion.
Oh. No.
I thought you were doing Batman for a second.
No.
Batman is kind of like the Phantom, though.
They have a lot in common.
I've never seen the sequel, and now I never will. It's non-canonical fiction as far as I'm concerned.
Sure. Fair. Incredibly fair.
Yes. It is as uncanonical as fiction
can get. It's fucking nonsense.
I've always sympathized with the Phantom and never really felt like there was a romantic connection between them.
Between who? Christine and
the Phantom.
Oh, sure.
I agree with that. Uh-huh. I think the Phantom, depending on the production that you're looking at, misunderstood monster, that kind of thing. And I like the reading that he loves her skill. He loves that she is so gifted. He is bewitched and entranced by her voice and wants to do something beautiful with it, but also is a little weird because he's lived the life that he has. Joanne goes on, it felt to me more like the Phantom viewed Christine as a pet slash daughter to obsess over.
Mm-hmm.
Not in, I'd say, a healthy way, but yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm examining my own internalized misogyny.
Well, that's fair too.
Possibly. She also says, in college, I took a counseling psychology class, and the big paper was writing a case study and treatment plan for a fictional character.
Oh.
This is very fun. I'm really intrigued by this. Guess who I chose? I would have had a very different approach if Love Never Dies had existed.
Oh, my God. Love Never Dies.
Yeah. I think the counseling approach versus Love Never Dies Phantom might be... I mean, the second one is alert the authorities.
Yeah.
She also advises that we Google image search Mare Bagwax.
Mare Bagwax. We will.
Yeah.
We will do that. Now, I assume this is for the horse mare, not for Louis B. Mare.
That is correct. Yes.
Okay.
So, James, prior to recording, I did Google that.
Oh, my God.
And Joanne also helpfully tweeted some mare bags at us, some images.
Oh, those. I did see those.
Yes.
Yes. It was like Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, boy. That's very flattering.
Mm.
It definitely feels like something that is private for the mayor and the mayor's companions to enjoy.
Do they make brassieres for horses so that you can conceal the bag in a secret bag of its own? There's no shame in the bag, Matthew.
Oh, no, there's no shame.
The horse should be nude and free.
It's meant to be public.
Matthew, the horse should be... Everyone should be comfortable with the bag.
There was also, for some reason, included in the Mare Bagwax image collection, just this very nice photograph of somebody's tote bag.
It's a nice bag.
Yeah, just a nice-looking striped tote bag. Mm. So that's what I'm choosing to think of right now instead.
Oh my goodness, Matthew, the mare bag. I never thought about horse tits until now. Well, until this came up, that they have them.
Yeah.
And that they're...
Well, they're mammals.
They're just not what I expected.
No.
I don't know what I expected, because, I mean, I think of pig.
I had no expectations.
Like, you know, I think of pig. I think of cow.
Mm-hmm.
I think of manimal. I think of all these creatures crawling the earth, making milk.
The human train from Starlight Express?
Exactly that. And I never have thought about a horse in that way.
No, neither have I. Now I'm thinking about trains with breasts.
That's right. Jane Krakowski from 30 Rock was a train
full
with breasts.
Circle, yes, Jane Krakowski from 30 Rock.
She was the dining car.
Broadway debut as Dinah the Dining Car in Starlight Express, Andrew Lloyd Webber's follow-up to Cats, where they were like, what if we did Cats but trains?
A prequel to Love Never Dies. They take her to Coney Island.
A train
ride,
does?
Well, I don't know. Let's say they ride Jane Krakowski
yep.
all the way to Coney Island.
Now, famously, this is a Broadway show that was performed entirely on roller skates, had the most number of injuries of any Broadway show. Mm-hmm. And it's not good. This is the other thing.
That's, yeah, all that suffering for what?
Yeah. Anyway, we'll talk about that more next week, perhaps. Or maybe we won't. I don't know if there's more to say about Starlight.
I'm not going to watch any more Starlight Express. All right.
I think we'll just call it an episode then.
Well, what do you say to make it happen that it's over now, yes?
Tookie de la Creme, I blow you out.